Hi there. You're listening to a sermon from the Murray River Baptist Church in Boronga, New South Wales, Australia. May the Lord challenge and encourage you through today's message.
We're going to touch on a few things. Now, one of the things about Esther is it's a book that obviously has no reference to God in it directly, as we stated once before. It doesn't say the name of God. We just kind of see God's handiwork through it. It's about this queen, you know, from an empire a long, long time ago. And a lot of people sometimes wonder, go, why do we care? You know, why do we care about this lady? But there's so much great truth in it, and you can see what God was doing and how God was directing. And a few points we just want to look at this morning and just kind of reflect on God's handiwork in here, and then some things for our life as we look at the life of this, not just this lady, but also what was going on in the Jewish people and things. So I'm just going to kind of set the context, very famous, but in case there's someone who may not be familiar with the context of what's going on in Esther, is that in Esther chapter 1, there's a king who very much gets upset with his wife because she refused to come to him at a party when he called for her. And so he then says, you know, well, that's it. I'm done with her. And so in Esther chapter 2, he decides, along with his advisors, they kind of plant the seed in his mind to go get another wife, you know, and go start a beauty contest. Basically, he calls in all the virgins of the land and brings them in, and they have to do a year's worth of preparations. And he's basically going to choose which lady will be his next bride. And so, you know, obviously there's a whole different culture and a whole different thing. And then I'd hate to be a lady at that time. I hate to be a lady any time for myself. But I'd hate to be a lady back then, during that time, to just get the thing saying, you're called into the, you know, to the king's palace, and you have no choice in it. And if he didn't choose you, you're still stuck there, many of them, and all. Because if those he kind of tried out, if he didn't marry them, which he only chose Esther, they were still stuck there, because once you were used by the king, you could never be married to anyone else. I mean, it was like their life was sealed, and that was it. And so it was a very, very tough situation for them. Esther gets the job, and because of her beauty and her personality and her spirit, he sees that and he chooses her. Then in chapter 3, we find about where we're going to be looking at things here about a man who's sort of the adversary of the book. You know, every good story needs an enemy. And here is the enemy of this book, and this man named Haman. So we're going to pick up starting here in chapter 3 and look at just the first beginning verses of this, and then make some points off of that. In chapter 3 of Esther, starting at verse 1, it says, after these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gates bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. Then the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said unto Mordecai, why do you transgress the king's commandment? Now it came to pass, when they spoke daily unto him, and he hearkened not to them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand. For he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had showed him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. In the first month, that is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast her, that is, the lots, before Haman from day to day, from month to month, to the 12th month, that is, the month Adar. And Haman said to the king Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from all people, neither keep they the king's laws. Therefore it is not for the king's profit to suffer them or to allow them. If it please the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business to bring it into the king's treasuries. All of that basically summarized saying, a guy got a bee in his bonnet, and he said, you know what? I don't like this guy, and I don't. It's too little to even just take it out on this guy. I'm going to take it out on his entire race. I mean, all because Mordecai would not bow as he would go into the city walls and the gates, that he said, I am so mad at this guy that I'm going to do something about it. Now, I'm not just going to take it out on him. I'm going to take it out on all of his people. And so he goes to the king, and he says, hey, king, I want to. Can you make a law that these rebellious people, they don't want to honor your laws, they don't want to keep your commands, they don't want to do any of these things. You don't want them in your kingdom. We need to purge them out. And so thusly the king then is going to allow that edict to be written and such. And so there is the sentence of death that is put upon the Jewish people. You know, but it's very interesting that Haman did get his whole hatred of the Jewish people because of one person, Mordecai. And how Mordecai acted or did not act according to what he expected. And we do find so much in society that people just base their opinions on a big spectrum of people based on maybe one experience. I'll never go to that restaurant again because I had one bad waiter. You know, there may be 10 good waiters, but because they have one bad waiter, they cast off the whole thing. Or I don't like, this certain race because this one person did something to me, and so they cast off the entire race. You know, and we see that very much in society. I mean, people castigate a whole group of people because of maybe the ills of one or a few. And so it all gets cast up. You know, a lot of people, I remember when we came here now, I think it's not as much anymore, but when we first moved here in the first couple of years, all the opinions people have about Americans, I heard them. You know, it was like, oh, you lousy Americans, you all do this and you all do that. And it's like, I know Americans are, there's that, the angry Americans and the loudmouth Americans everywhere you go. And, they are, there's no doubt. But some people didn't like Americans because of their experiences with others. And so they wouldn't give me a shot. It was like, oh, you're an American. And so when I got my citizenship and said, no, I am as much Australian as you, they're like, no, you're still American. I got a paper that says I'm Australian. No, you're American. And so it was just like cast off all because of one. And we see very much that even in society, today, Christianity gets painted with a broad brush because of the ills of a few. There is no doubt, sadly, that there's a bad segment of Christianity. You know, Christianity gets labeled just like the Jewish people got labeled because of one man, Mordecai. Christianity gets labeled as, and I'm sure we've all heard these things, judgmental. Oh, judgmental! You know, why? Because there are definitely people who are very judgmental. You know, they look at you cross-eyed if you dress different or you have something. I mean, they just, you're people, you're going to hell, and all that. And there are very, very judgmental Christians, and because of that, we all get labeled that way. You have those very much who are just, very unkind when they speak to people. They it's sort of like, they're the elitist, we're in the truth and you're in the wrong. And it's very elitist, very snobbish, look down on people and think. There's no doubt that there's a reason people think that. Because are there not many Christians who do those things? Yes, sadly, they do. The whole idea of hypocrites, Christians are nothing but hypocrites. Well, people get that opinion because why? There are hypocrites out there. And so there are no doubt that people form an opinion about Christianity based off of the wrongs of a few. And what we need to really try to do is try to help reshape people's opinions of what it means to be a Christian. To really try to reshape that. Yes, there are a bad segment of people there. There's no doubt. It's sad that they claim the same title we do. But it doesn't mean then we should cast aside all of it. And we have to show by our kindness, by our love, by our mercy, by our way we deal with them, as we just finished up a couple weeks back at looking in Romans 12, dealing with those who are not in Christ, and how we deal with those who are in Christ, blessing those that persecute you. You do that, and that will smooth out how some people will think about what Christians are. You know, bless those that persecute you, you know, and help those who are in need. We do that, that can help change a few people's opinions. There's no doubt, when we meet with people and they know you're a Christian, you're either adding to what they already think, or hopefully you're going to challenge them to maybe think different. You know, I can't even count on my hands and feet how many times I've heard people say, "You're a pastor? You don't act like one." Like, I don't know really what that means about how pastors act. I don't know, you know. But they say, you don't come across like a pastor. You seem down to earth. And I'm thinking, what should be different, you know, and such. But I know what they mean, though, because you have these people who, you know, "I am the man of God. You will hear me." You know, Sarah saw this when we were in the States. We were at a church, and this was one of those, like, lively churches. I mean, they were lively. They sang. They were great. They sang, I'd say, best singing and I've heard in forever. Best pianist I think I've ever heard in my life. I mean, this lady knew what to do with the piano. Best pianist I've ever heard in my life. Well, anyway, this was one of these amening churches. You ever hear amening churches? You know, pastor can say anything. Let's open to the book of Esther. Amen! You know, and oh, I mean, they just amen everything. And so the guy was preaching, and he was preaching about marriage and things. And this one man from the back, I mean, and without exaggeration, this is what he would do. The guy would make a point, whatever, say a thing, and the guy would go, "Preach it, man of God!" I mean, as loud as that. And I'm like, whoa, what in the world, you know? And he did that throughout the entire service. "Preach it, man of God!" You know, I'm thinking, are we all, you know, I mean, as silly as that is, the whole title, man of God, aren't we all just people of God, you know, like, but there's some people who, "I am the man of God, hear me, where I say it, I am biblically trained in exegetical things, and I know all this, and you don't, shame on you, and you will hear me," you know, no, we can help change the way people view what Christianity is. You know, we can help. We're either aiding and abetting the views already there by our judgmentalism, by our hypocriticalism, if that's a word, by all of our things, or we can help reshape their thing, or at least challenge them on, this is different. This is what Christianity truly should be about. It's about Christ and trying to live out Christ, not about judging people and looking elitist and, you know, you have to dress with a tie or a skirt. All it just, we can help change your opinion. But there's no doubt, human nature, opinions of all of people get shaped by one. And Haman hated the Jews, all of the Jews, because of one. And so may we use that aspect of human nature and try to shape some others. When you're at work, treating, you know, showing people a different way of what Christianity is. When you're in your community, showing people a different way of what Christianity is. And just living it out and showing it and influencing the thinking of others. Now, there will be people you never change. There's no doubt there will be some people whose opinions locked in and they will never change. And that's it forever and ever and ever. But thankfully, there are some people who can be challenged and say, "Wow, you are different than what I thought a Christian is." And may we do that, because unfortunately people's opinions they paint the broad brush off of the opinion of one. Then continuing on, as we looked in here, Haman, he gets his hatred towards the Jews and Mordecai particularly. But then I want you to look at here, now these are things we kind of usually just gloss over and never even think about. But there's actually some importance to this whole thing. In Esther 3, looking at verse 7, we get this kind of little detail of a timeline. in the first month, that is in the month Nisan. Now, of course, our thinking, when we think first month, we think January. Their calendar was different. They had different names and all that. The Roman calendar didn't come and didn't come until later. And also, this is the Hebrew calendar, so it is a bit different. But you just process in your head, and you can. It's okay to process January, even though that's not what their calendar date was. But in the first month, Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is the lots, before Haman from day to day, from month to month, to the 12th month, that is the month Adar. What that verse is basically saying is this. All right, Haman is upset. I want to do something. He goes to cast lots. Now, what cast lots basically was, well, you see that throughout the aspects of the Old Testament, as well as you see it a few times mentioned in the New Testament. Casting lots was sort of like picking pick the short end of the straw thing, you know, whoever gets the short straw. And it was sort of like that. It was sort of like we're going to do something to, and whichever one we get, that's the one that the gods have shaped, or that's the one God has chosen for us. And all. So it's not something you see throughout, after they cast lots for the early church apostles and things, and who's going to replace Judas, who died, you don't see him casting lots anymore. But up until that time, you see it in the book in Jonah, when Jonah's on the thing, they cast lots, who's the one who's guilty, you know, and so they cast lots to figure that out and such. So it was sort of like a way of trying to figure out divine wisdom based on, like, choose the short straw, you know, and that's the one that, that's the one that is. So what Haman does is he's like, all right, I want to do something to these Jewish people, all right? And January, he's like, I don't want to do something. So he goes to his, you know, people, and they, I'm sure he would have probably had a Persian god he would have been praying to and such. And so he's like, all right, reveal to me when we can do this, when we can eliminate these people. And he goes and he chooses the straw and, you know, did whatever it would have specifically been done. And it comes out, the detail says, the 12th month, December, you know, in our thinking. All right, so here he is in January. Oh, I have such hatred, I want to wipe these people out. And when he chooses the straw, or chooses the cast of lots, it comes out to be revealed, okay, you can put this in action in December. That's 11 months away. You know, and what we see, do you think that's just a coincidence? No. What we see is that even though he was, you know, probably relying on his gods, Persian gods, what we see is the handiwork of God in the timing of things. You know, the handiwork of God in the timing of things. You know, that this 11 months is going to allow all the story to start, get in the middle, and finish way before that time comes. You know, and so it's no coincidence, not by accident. Oops, I just chose this one. This was something that God did, you know, and which shows us something about who God is and the timing of God and how God works. You know, and the book of Proverbs tells us in chapter 16, verse 33, that the answers to the lots are given by God in Proverbs 16, 33. So God ultimately was watching over it, even though Haman didn't realize it. But I want to now look at this whole idea of timing and how timing works. Because this was not an accident. 11 months was going to be before he can execute them. Can you imagine being so frustrated with that? You know, he goes and he pulls it out. He's like, oh, I got to wait 11 months. Oh, I want to kill him now. But 11 months he waited because he believed that's what his God had showed him. And so we want to look at God's timing. Because this is something that impacts us all, and sometimes we never even consider it. The timing of God in the situations of our life. Here we see, obviously, 11 months given for the span for the execution. It allows a lot of time in between. But then, when you look at the whole story of Esther, okay, in Esther chapter 2, you look there, just glance over, and you're going to see there that verse 16. So Esther was taken unto King Ahasuerus in his house royal in the 10th month, which is in the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Okay, so in our thinking, again, in October of the 7th year of his reign as king. He started the process in his fourth year, so it took 3 years for him to find his bride. You know, it's a long time him trying out ladies. And so here she is in the seventh. Now, what happens immediately after this, she gets into the position of queen. Then we have, and in fact, this is what Claymore read that time when he did his verses, verse 21 to verse 23. Okay, so in the seventh year of king's reign, this story happened. Verse 21. In those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, were wroth and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it to Esther the queen, and Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. And when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore, they were both hanged on a tree, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. So that was in year 7 of his reign. Okay, this whole thing, go back to chapter 3, verse 7, in the first month, the month Nisan, in the 12th year. 5 years have passed. Now, we read it, we think it's like the next day. Just humanly, we read it, we just think it's the next day, and it's like, oh, okay, check that out. 5 years have passed between chapter 2 and chapter 3. And what's going to happen and how God works is that you have Mordecai's situation where he rescued the king and he, you know, kind of revealed the assassination plot. But nothing happens for 5 years regarding the guy. And just at the perfect time, it bore forth fruit right when it was needed. You know, later on in the later chapters, in chapter number 6, when Haman thinks he's going to get praised by the king, but then yet it turns to praise Mordecai, and it just really eats up Haman. 5 years had passed. Now, what we see is that sometimes when we do work, you know, and we sometimes think there's no benefits, we never know what God's going to do down the road. You know, you never know the seeds you plant now, what they may bring out down the road. We like to see immediate results. I mean, that's just human nature. We want to see immediate things. If we show kindness to someone, we want to see them to respond to that kindness straight away. If we give the gospel to someone, we'd love to see them respond to the gospel right away. If we are trying to input truth into our kids, we want to see them respond to that truth in their heart right away. Doesn't work that way all the time, does it? And sometimes we just think, oh, why? When is it going to change? When is something going to happen here? Well, here, Mordecai did his thing, and it didn't bear forth fruit until 5 years later, right when God knew this is when it's needed to be done. You know, and God's timing in this whole book is all throughout. You know, God's timing on when that lot was cast. God's timing on when Esther was given that job, and then when Mordecai was going to be, given the reward by the king. All of this is going out. And as we think about our lives, don't ever quit. You know, you plant that seed, and you keep plugging away. You never know. It may be 5 years. It may be 10 years. It may be 15 years. It may be in the life like a Moses, 40 years. If we finally see something come as a result, God knows what time. No, and we struggle with that. But we have to trust God. God, I'm trying to do what you tell me to do, but it seems to bear no fruit. It seems to bear no result. Get back to trusting God for the timetable, though. God, I'm depending on you. God, I'm resting in you. I think one of the most fruitless, seemingly fruitless ministries is dealing with kids. You know, is dealing with kids, particularly teens. You know, you can do everything for teens. I love them. But you pour into them, and oftentimes you see, they don't come up to you and go, thanks, Pastor Malda, for that work you've done in my life. Thanks for that activity. Thanks for that Bible study. That was really good. All my years of dealing with teens, very rarely have I ever had a teen say, you know what, thank you for what you're doing for us. But down the track, and you see their heart still going for God, and they say, hey, thanks for all you did for us. So like when they're 25 and they say, thanks for what you did, you know, it's like, yeah, it was worth it. You don't get immediate results. And when we're dealing with people and we're trying to, you know, we talked about Romans 12, you know, helping, you know, dealing with those who persecute you. Bless them that persecute you. And it would be like putting coals of fire upon their head, you know, and things. And we may think, well, when will it ever happen? When will it finally be worth all the effort I'm putting in? Where it may take a long time. But God knows the timing. And that's what we have to trust. And that's what we have to see. And as we go through this book, timing is important. And we see God's hand through the whole thing. Never give up when you get frustrated and you want to quit. You think, what's the worth? Why keep going on? You never know what God may do with what you've planted down the road. Keep plugging away. It may bear forth fruit down the pike. Then, as we go on, we'll look over to chapter number 8. And in chapter number, as the story went, and as you hopefully read through the story, if you have, you know, Queen Esther reveals to the king that Haman had this plot to kill the Jewish people, of which one she is. And so the king says, whoa, can't have that. So the king steps out in anger. I love this. I could just see the scene unfold in your head. You know, the king steps out in anger. Oh, I can't believe Haman's going to do this. He goes out to take a walk. Haman comes, you know, pleads by the feet of Esther, you know, kind of, please, what are you doing? But because they were in a dining situation, they weren't sitting in chairs. They were all reclining, you know, in that culture, you would recline. And so she's kind of reclining on the floor. Haman comes down and kind of pleads with her. And the king walks in and says, what? Are you trying to assault my wife right here in front of me? Ah, and so he goes, has him killed. I mean, it's just great how God works all that out. And so Haman is dead. Mordecai then gets put into the position of leadership over the things of Haman. But now you still have this death plot to kill all the Jews that's still hanging in the air. And so what's going to happen then is here in chapter number 8. And we'll pick up at verse number 5. Esther speaking, and she says, if it please the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and the thing seems right before the king, and I be pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to reverse the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews, which are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that shall come upon my people, or how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred? Then the king Ahasuerus said to Esther the queen and to Mordecai the Jew, behold, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged on the gallows because he laid his hand upon the Jews. Write also for the Jews, as it likes you, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's ring. For the writing which is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's ring, no man may reverse. Then were the king's scribes called at that time in the third month, that is in the month Sivan, on the 23rd day, and it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded unto the Jews, and to the lieutenants, and to the deputies, and the rulers of the provinces, which are from India, unto Ethiopia, 127 provinces, unto every province according to the writing thereof, and unto every people after their language, and to the Jews according to their writing, and according to the language. And right there you have the longest verse in the Bible. Esther 8:9 is the longest verse in the Bible. And if you're ever going to learn and memorize a verse, I don't recommend Esther 8:9. Just a really long one. But what you do have there, though, is that the Esther says to the king, king, we got this situation with the thing still kind of hanging over. And so the king says, all right, Esther, you and Mordecai can write out whatever you want to write out and seal it with my ring, and that will put it into action. And so they go, and that verse 9 is basically about them writing a letter that says every Jewish person can defend themselves and can fight against those that are going to kill them. So anyone tries to come kill them, the Jews can attack and fight them and kind of be on the offensive rather than just on the defensive. And that was what they came up with. But what we have there is you have the sentence of death that was lingering over. All right, you had the one, Haman, who hated them and wanted them to die. And so now there's a glimmer of hope. Esther and Mordecai, while they're in the castle, writes this edict out on the third month. So now we saw everything unfold in January, like in our thinking, the first month. So now this is the third month in March. So all of the, basically between chapter 3 and here, it happens in a two-month span. So you have a lot condensed into 2 months, and then it's going to now go forward for a few months till the end of the year. But what you have is they write this out, and the glimmer of hope. And what we're going to see here is so important. You got this edict written now. Now what? Well, what happens is so important and a lesson for the Christian church today. Because you have them writing it out, and then in verse 10, he wrote it in the king's Ahasuerus' name, sealed it with the king's ring, sent letters by posts on horseback and riders, on mules, camels. And those horses were super fast horses. I mean, they were trained to be the fastest horses. That's what's written in the Hebrew there. And so these guys said, all right, there's a sentence of death on everyone. We have the truth, this hope. We have to do everything we can to get this answer of hope to the people. And so, you messengers, you get on your horses and you fly like the wind, bullseye, and may we get this message out to everyone so that they can know. And that is what the Christian church needs to be doing. There is the sentence of death on everyone. All are sinners. The penalty of sin is death. Separation from God for all eternity. And yet we have the message of hope. We have the message of which they need. We have this thing, but yet we sort of like, oh, we'll get it out when we get a chance. No, these people said, we are going to get this message out and we're going to get it passed. There's a couple things that jot it down that they did that we need to do. One, they moved out with expediency. They moved out with expediency. They got out fast. Let's get out there, get the message of hope to these people to save them from the sentence of death. They got out there with expediency. And may we do that. These folks didn't wait around and say, well, okay, this is only March. You know, we have till December. You know, it's a bit warm right now. We'll wait till later. No, they didn't just sit and go, oh, we have time. They went and they got out. And that's, we need to have that within us as well. What can we do to share the gospel? Now, not everyone's going to respond, of course. But are we at least communicating it to people? Are we sharing it with people? We have the message of hope for those in the sentence of death. What are we doing about it? They went out with expediency. They went out fast. Then we see they went out with urgency. When you look at later on there, it says in verse number 14, so the post, though, the messengers that rode upon the mules and the camels went out, being hastened and pressed on by the king's commandment. You know, they were spurred on by the king's command. And so when they were tired, it's like, they had 127 provinces across the whole empire. The empire was huge. You know, I mean, it stretched from near India over to near Egypt. I mean, it was huge. And so you have to get this message out all over. All right, so can you imagine a guy who's, you know, who's got to go all the way to near India? That's a long travel by horse, you know, and from where the palace was. But when he was getting tired, thinking, oh, I'll stop. Nope, I got to keep going. Why? Because my king told me to get this command out. Because why? These people will die if I don't get this message of hope to them. When they were tired, they remembered the king's command. When they wanted to quit, I'm sure they remembered the king's command. And what we need to do as the church is, we know that there's throughout this whole world, that there are people who need the message of hope. We need to get it out fast. We need to do everything we can. And we can't quit. We have to remember, when we're tired, thinking, oh, another ministry, oh, another thing to try, oh, another person. We have to keep going. Why? Because we're spurred on by our king's command. The King of Kings and Lord of Lords has said, get out into all the world and make disciples. Get out there and share the gospel with them. And may we have the same impetus upon us as these messengers did on them. the king told us to do it, we are going to do it. So they went out with urgency. They went out with expediency. And they went out with suitability. That verse number 9, the really long one, I love what it says there. You know, they had 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia, but they wrote this edict into every people after their language, and to the Jews according to their writing and according to their language. They met, they got it into the language of the people. They, you know, and as we have this message of hope for the gospel, you know, we have the most foolish thing is to take an English thing into places they don't speak English. You know, I know sadly missionaries who try to teach those people English just so they can get the Bible. No! Get the gospel into their language, get it so that they read it, they know it, and such. And what we need to do is, how can we help those who are helping get the language into the Word of God into their languages? Bible printing ministries, the Gideon's Bible study, those who are translating the gospel into hundreds of languages. We should support them and help them, because why? People need the gospel of hope in their language so they can read, this is what God has done for us. We were under the sentence of death. There is hope. You know, and sadly, so much of the Christian church has messed this up in just trying to, you know, this fits every culture. No, it doesn't fit every culture the way we do things here. It's got to be some adaptability to suit that culture and language and people group. And may people learn that, and may we understand that. We need to support those who are putting the Bible into the language of the people. Now, and really supporting them, because that's exactly, these people need this message in their language. And so we need to understand our responsibility with the gospel. You know, and there may be someone here, you know, we don't want to just spread the gospel to all the world and then miss our community. We have to see that we have to get it out to all over our community and throughout the world. We have a responsibility, and even our little group, we have a responsibility to do what we can to get it out to all the provinces of the world. And to do what we can, support missionaries, help send out missionaries, and do what we can, help these Bible societies and Gideons and things like that. But may we understand the message of hope. That every single person, regardless of how kind, sweet, nice they are, is under the sentence of death. Men and women are sinners. Separated by that sin, breaking of God's laws for the wrong we've done from an almighty perfect God. And there is no hope. There is no way that man can fix that gulf that is there. There is nothing. We can't be kind enough. We can't be good enough. We can't be nice enough. We can't go to church enough. We can't give enough money. We can't be baptized enough. We can't do anything enough. There's nothing that can fix this sentence of death upon us. And God knew that. And so God said, you can't do it. I will help bridge the gap. And God the Son came down to earth, took on the form of humanity in Jesus Christ, and he did everything necessary to allow those with the sentence of death to be able to have life again. To be able to have life. He gives life. And the greatest thing we can communicate to our friends, neighbors, community, is that you don't have to suffer under the sentence of death. Because there's no doubt we can't do anything. And without... And with us doing nothing, and if we don't do anything about it with what Jesus has done, we are going to die and we will be forever separated from God in the place called the lake of fire. There's no doubt about that. That's exactly what God says, and he says in the book of Revelation, this is the second death, a sentence of death upon us. And so, we have the gospel of hope. We have the message of life. We have the thing that the king has given us to say, get it out. It's all over. May we have the same desire to share with people the gospel. You don't have to go to hell. You don't have to be in the lake of fire. Jesus has done everything to rescue you from that. And it's understanding Jesus, God the Son, who lived a perfect life, took on him voluntarily and willingly. They deserve the punishment, but I will take it on myself. They deserve to be separated from you, Father, but I will take it upon myself. And when we put our confidence and trust and reliance on the work of Jesus for us, that's salvation. And that's when Jesus gives new life. The sentence of life, eternal, rather than the message of death. We have a great message we have. Do we get it out? Can you imagine if these guys would have just, I got time. You know, when that December 12th came, or December 13th day came, in our calendar thinking, those people were able to fight, and not one of them died. Because why? Someone got the message out to them. And may we do our part to get the message out. I'll close with this. What if we treated the gospel message like the messengers did? You know what? If we, as well as the Christian church as a whole, treated the gospel message like the messengers did, we'd reach our world. At least get it out there. You know, we'd get it out there, but there's so many different languages and people groups that I've never heard. If we did it the way the messengers did it, the world would have much more God awareness of Jesus Christ than they do. What if the messengers, though, treated their news the way we treat the gospel? I don't think, as we read in Esther 9, when everyone was rescued and saved, that probably wouldn't have happened. Because the Christian church has become very lazy with the gospel. We got time. There's time. Well, they had 9 months to get out, but yet they hastened on by the king's command. Let's get it out now. May we do consider, what are we doing? Are we sharing with our friends? Are we even trying to share with our friends? Are we doing anything, you know, with the gospel in my community? And am I helping by financially giving to help people who are getting the gospel out around the world? You know, I mean, we give to missionaries, and we have, what, 5 mission things? Maybe more we could support if we had more money for it and such. Getting that message out and doing all we can. So Esther, this book of Esther, you know, we see God's timing. We see how God's working. And then we see this message of the gospel. May we do what we can to keep working even when it seems like there's no fruit, because you never know what God may do down the road. And may we do what we can to get the gospel message out, because it is the message of life. May we conclude in prayer.
Thank you for listening to today's sermon. We encourage you to leave a comment regarding today's message, either on the sermon audio webpage or through the church website. It can be found at murrayriverbaptist.com. We would love to hear from you. And remember, there are many more sermons to be heard on the websites. And we look forward to you joining us in the future.